to the best in progressive conversation, news, and entertainment.
Welcome to the Progressive Radio News Hour. I'm Steve Lindman. My guest today is Robert Aberle. Bob is professor of humanities and philosophy at Diablo Valley College, California. He's written four books that I'm aware of. Maybe he's got another one in prospect. They include Democracy Gone, Anatomy of a Deception. It's about the Iraq invasion, the occupation, and preparation for the next deception. We've talked about it on this program. There's always another deception. There are multiple deceptions. We discuss them on this program all the time. We want to talk about all the duplicitous things that America's government is planning and plotting and committing. Oh, my God. Bob, if America had a rap sheet, it would surpass anything in world history. Welcome.
Thanks, Steven. Good to be with you again.
Oh, it's great to have you on. We got fouled up the last time. I had a schedule, something or other. I just can't imagine what went wrong. But you were supposed to come on, and I botched up my schedule, and I messed it up. Thankfully, I got you back on okay today. Let's talk about what you've written about recently. You've written about the assassination program. I wrote about it. Talk about the article that you wrote.
Sure. Yeah, you've got something similar to that, too. What I did was I looked at the white paper that was released by NBC on the Justice Department's alleged legal defense of the executive's authority to assassinate American citizens. And I, like I said in my article, I don't know that anyone who reads that has a conscience couldn't be completely appalled by it. I mean, by any ethical analysis, it's a complete abomination. And the article that I wrote was taking some of the twisted definitions that they give, or maybe it would be more accurate and fair to say the rewording, the redefining of various terms so broadly beyond every traditional constraint that was put into law about these terms that it allows Obama to make that claim of executive authority. Perhaps the easiest way to go is the one that's the most egregious in the article that the white paper that they wrote up from the Justice Department, and that's the term imminence. The primary justification that this white paper in the Obama administration gives for the president being allowed to assassinate American citizens, basically anybody he wants to, is the definition of imminence. Now, the traditional meaning of imminence in both ethics of warfare and now international law is when another nation is physically observed to be planning an immediate attack, like the traditional definition uses the example of lining its troops up on a border. So today we could add to that it's fueling its jets and it's putting its jets on the war jets on the runway, getting ready to attack. That is the definition of imminence in international law that allows an attack for a nation that has not yet been attacked. Now, in the white paper, what the Obama administration does is it says imminence means al-Qaeda leaders who are continually planning attacks. So imminence now, under Obama, has gone from we see that we are directly being threatened by another nation to a small little subgroup that we know makes plans to attack, and that's enough for imminence to be fulfilled. And then it adds two other things to it. First, it doesn't require the United States to have any clear evidence that a specific attack is coming. Just that we know these guys tend to plan attacks, and so that's all we need for imminence. And then it says that the U.S. government can't be confident that no such attacks are coming. So in other words, we can't prove a negative. Therefore, we have just proven the positive so that we can allow ourselves to attack anybody that we know that tends to plan attacks. Now, you can't have a broader definition of imminence than that. And if they give themselves executive authority to assassinate people on the basis of that, then you have, in fact, transcended all definitions in international law and ethics and given yourself complete authority over the life of others. The terms are just so broadly defined all the way through, and that's what my article did. It just took the terms, showed how they were defined, and then showed how the traditional legal and ethical definitions aren't anywhere close to what they did and they're taking absolute authority over American citizens and the lives of others on the basis of that type of sophistic, rhetorical, legal justification. I'll stop there just for a second.
Oh, Bob, it is so true. We both remember during the Bush administration, John Yoo, who I think is still teaching at UC Berkeley's Bolt Law School. Last time I heard, yep, he was teaching there, and students, at least I recall, whether they're doing it now, I'm not certain, but they would boycott his class. His classes were so boycotted, they had to give him a secret location. I don't know how you keep a professor's classroom location secret. I mean, the kids in it need to know where to go, and they have, I mean, they have friends. I don't know how you suppress that information, but they wanted to try to keep down the crowds protesting that this criminal lawyer this morning, Francis Boyle, distinguished law professor, comes on this program every now and then. He was on a week ago, this past Friday. This morning I exchanged some emails with him on this very topic. He said, oh, a few years ago he wrote about, don't send your children to Harvard Law School, and he ticked off five Harvard Law School professors who were in the tank for power, Bob. And he mentioned another one that was not in his article that he said, a man by the name of David Barron with two R's on the Harvard Law School faculty, and Francis said he wrote the Department of Justice memo authorizing the murder of U.S. citizens for Obama. Those are Francis Boyle's words. I'm not familiar with David Barron, but you see what these guys do, Bob. You know, they sell their souls for a buck. They twist the law. They're well paid for doing it. They have prestigious positions in top law schools. And they're involved conspiratorially in killing people. John Yoo did it. David Barron's doing it. Alan Dershowitz, of course, is at Harvard Law School. And there are a bunch of others, too. And Elena Kagan, I believe I got her first name right, Elena Kagan, the newest U.S. Supreme Court justice, when she was the dean of Harvard Law School, she hired a bunch of these people. I mean, putting killer lawyers on the Harvard faculty made her a Supreme Court justice. Astonishing the way this country is run, Bob.
That's the way it is. I mean, it's just a matter not of what values you have, but of who you're connected to. And to be connected today requires that you basically, you're right, sell your soul of your values in favor of maintaining the network. That's really kind of the way that it works, and I find that just to be repulsive. By the way, a quick thing about what happened to John Yoo. The students weren't just picketing his classes, they were picketing him at his house in Berkeley.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And so what Berkeley did is they moved him to Orange County, California, or the Southern California, either for a semester or a year. I think it was a full year because the heat was so great. So they put him down there and he taught there for a year. Now he's back, and now there's a whole lot less heat. So that was the move that they made. So they didn't have to kind of keep his classrooms quiet. They just sent him to Southern California for a while. That's how they did it. And by the way, back to the drone things that we started with, this was actually, I think it was yesterday this news came out, that the Federal Aviation Administration, the FAA, announced that they're soliciting six proposals to do research and test sites for the use of American drones, or drones on American soil. Ray LaHood said it directly, that we're going to do research in the United States to give us great information about how best to introduce drones to American skies. And the FAA predicted in their statement that they expect to have 10,000 drones used over the U.S. skies by 2018. Now, right now, there's only, to my knowledge, there's been just a handful of police departments that have asked for FAA drones or the use of FAA drones. But the drone advocates, according to the article that I had read, the makers of the drones, Michael Toscano, the president and CEO of the Unmanned Vehicle System International, said that he's targeting all 18,000 law enforcement agencies as being drone customers. So that's where the drones are coming. So, that, like I said in my paper, or my article this week on the drones, make no mistake about it, if a president is willing to kill American citizens abroad and use drones to get what he wants, whether it's killing or not, he will not limit his actions to foreign soil. And that's what's happening. So right after that, there was legislation introduced by an interesting combination, a Democrat from California, Zoe Lofgren, and Ted Poe, a Republican of Texas, of all things, that is going to attempt to limit the use of domestic drones to criminal cases and emergencies. And the basis of the law is a right to a reasonable expectation of privacy. So we'll have to see where this goes, but that information all just came out yesterday. So now Obama is trying to push it in the domestic skies. So we've got to go back to this paper and look at what power he is claiming and then realize that that power is coming back here. And that should really put the fear into people who are trying to ignore this issue of drones.
You can't ignore it, Bob, and it's been at least 6 months. But I wrote an article that I think the title of was Eye in the Sky Spying on Americans, and it was about putting something like 20 or 30,000 drones virtually blanketing the country by something like 2020. And these will be the same type predator drones that are killing mostly civilians, and I wrote about that too. I wrote about a study conducted by Stanford University and NYU, and one of the conclusions of this study was only 2% of those killed by U.S. drones in theater, in war theaters in other areas, whether it's Yemen, whether it's Afghanistan, Pakistan, Somalia, wherever they're used, the targeted people are 98% non-high-value targets. In other words, they're civilians. They're innocent men, women, children, infants, the elderly, the infirm, only 2%. Are the ones that they go after. And, of course, the Pentagon and Obama and whoever is Secretary of Defense, Hagel no doubt will become it, even though they're boxing his ears, they all deny it. They're all liars. They're all war criminals. They should be in prison, not government. But the way America is run, Bob, the killers are the ones who rule the country and want to rule the world, and the innocent ones are the ones that get murdered and blamed for the crimes of the guilty. Shocking stuff, Bob. And even more shocking is the indifference of the American public about this. Why in hell aren't they rallying in rage to do something about this? And I say it repeatedly on this program all the time. If ordinary people don't do something for their own welfare, they're going to end up with the tyranny they deserve. They've got most of it now. The full Monty is on the way, and it could arrive any time. It may already be here, but we don't know it, because Obama started straight away in his administration not only to follow all the Bush police state laws, but to start adding on more of his own, and he sure piled on plenty.
And you said that it was a patent lie, what Obama's been saying about drones and what Feinstein, I guess, and others have said. And that's not an overstatement. If you watched, I'm sure you watched the John Brennan hearings, on Capitol Hill, and I guess if I even said kid gloves that they handled him with, that would be an understatement itself. But Feinstein herself said, I listened to her say this, and then it was on the news again later that day. She claimed that the annual civilian lives that were killed were in the single digits. Now, anybody who has read anything about drones knows that that's a lie. I mean, all you have to do is look at some of the reports that have been put together by Pakistan, for example, and also objective sources like ACLU and other human rights organizations. We know that there's been 336 drone attacks in Pakistan in the last 8 years under Bush and Obama. We know that over 2,000 people have been killed. Some people say over 3,000. We know that 80% of those were innocent civilians, because both Bush and Obama admitted, yeah, we attacked a wedding party, or yeah, we attacked a meeting of a group of people, or yeah, we attacked a neighborhood. And yet Feinstein's going to say in public at John Brennan's confirmation hearing that we've only killed people in the single digits. That can't be anything other than a lie. So you're right. And now we know that the U.S. media lied, covering up the U.S. assassination base in Saudi Arabia. And the Obama administration has been flying out of there using its kill list, like, Anwar al-Awlaki. He was assassinated through the base in Saudi Arabia. And if you go back to bin Laden, what was bin Laden's big complaint with the U.S.? That we're putting our assassination machines in Saudi Arabia on holy soil. So what are we doing? We open up an assassination base there so we can fly our drones out from there. So this is going to really cause some blowback, along with, well, we can get into this a little bit, I suppose, with what we're doing in Syria and other places as well. It presents a real serious problem that, and for the life of me, ending with the way you just ended it, I don't know why we aren't screaming bloody murder about that. I'm still trying to figure that out. I think that a lot of people support Obama thinking that he wouldn't dare bring the machinery this way, that he brings that way in foreign soil, and I think that's going to be shown actually through the Christopher Dorner case in L.A. this week. That's already shown to be a complete fabrication or complete self-told lie, because they'll certainly not hesitate to do it. Just look at what they did to Dorner this week.
Well, I wrote about that too, Bob, and it's no surprise. The people who listen to this program, they understand this. They understand it very, very well. The only thing I would say to them is spread the word and tell other people. But overall, the people who get the so-called news from television, when somebody like Dianne Feinstein, who's one of the wealthiest women in the Senate, which already is a millionaire's club, John Kerry, the new Secretary of Defense, he's no longer a senator, the richest man in the Senate with his wife's fortune, the Hines fortune, I don't know how much money how much he's worth. He didn't have to count his wife's money in it, but between the two, I mean, he was wealthy himself. He one of the wealthiest in the Senate on his own, but you put his money together with his wife's, and they're worth, dare I say, multi-billions of dollars. And he's picking up right where Hillary Clinton left off. But Feinstein, this despicable woman, this is the same woman who referred to John Brennan, a despicable killer. He called him, in her words, quote-unquote, brilliant. Remarkable, I think, was the word. Remarkable.
Yeah.
Calling a killer remarkable. Maybe she'd feel the same way about a mafia hitman, except a Brennan kills a lot more. He may not be as well paid for it. I have no idea. He can steal all he wants and get away with it. But this is what Feinstein says, in single digits.
Yeah, and Brennan as remarkable is another good one. The interesting thing is that, and by the way, the answer to your question is that about how much she is worth. Her fortune, if I remember correctly, is over $45 million by herself, and that makes her the fifth richest in the U.S. Senate, because I keep a running tab on who's the richest and what they're doing.
Her husband is extremely wealthy, too.
I'm sorry, say again?
Her husband is
her
very
husband,
wealthy.
Yeah, right. Not counting her husband, just her own worth.
Just her own wealth. And, of course, she sees to it that her husband gets friendly legislation passed. Isn't that part of the dirty game, Bob?
Absolutely. That's part of the network that you're in when you surrender any type of objective values in favor of self-interest. That's what you get.
I still remember about John Kerry, and I wrote about this. This goes back a ways, several years or longer. John Kerry has either six or seven homes. Six or seven homes. What in hell do you need with six or seven homes? Maybe he and his wife get together every evening and decide, where will we live tomorrow night?
While over 100 million Americans are asking, where will we live?
Exactly. You go out in the street in Chicago on a freezing cold day. It's really shocking downtown in a part of the city that's not exactly a shabby part, and you see people on the street. It could be any hour of the day or night, and they're asking for any kind of help they can get. But these people, they'll sleep in doorways. They'll sleep anywhere they can. I don't know how they survive, and John Kerry has six or seven homes.
And Obama says that we are well on the way to economic recovery. You watched his State of the Union address, and you even wrote on it. And at the same time, we know that the only ones who are recovering from this are the top 1%. I mean, it was just released this week by the University of California. Remember what he teaches, Emmanuel Saez, I think his name is Saez, that he released these economic figures showing that in the last 2 years, the economic recovery that allegedly started in 2008 or 2009, depending upon who you talk to, the incomes of the top 1%, they captured 121% of the whole income gains over the last 2 years of the recovery. And the bottom 99% got, at best, about 11%. And he predicts that in 2012, 2013, 2014, those incomes at the top level are going to surge because of the booming stock market now. So when Obama takes the podium during the State of the Union and says the economic recovery is well underway now, he's referring to the stock market boom and the 1%, and that shows you who his true masters are when he says that, and everybody claps for him. The only thing that I can see going on is that there's still a massive transfer of wealth going on that started in 2008 and continues to go. And now what some people are referring to as the asset bubbles have been reflated, because what's happening is these people are doing speculation again. And they're involving themselves in these economic dirty deals, not even saying anything about the fact that unemployment is still going up. It's not going down. And the ones who are in positions of employment now are underemployed, in part thanks to Obama. His restructuring of the auto industry in 2009 makes sure that workers don't get paid what they need to get paid. And so Obama, I'm going to add one more thing and then I'll stop. During the State of the Union, while he's talking about the economic recovery, he starts panning for raising the federal minimum wage to $9 an hour. But if you remember what he said in 2008 when he was running for president, he said we need it at $9.50 an hour. And so here we are 4 years later, 5 years later, and he's going backwards. So it really means that people that would be working today under minimum wage would make less, adjusted for inflation, than the people who were doing what they did in 1968. And at the same time, from all accounts, Obama has put out the order to the Democrats in Congress, don't speak against this. Even though, don't say anything about, even in Ontario and Canada, the minimum wage is close to $11 an hour. In Australia, it's $15 an hour. Don't say anything about CEOs who make $10 million a year. He's clamped his own party from saying anything, while at the same time backtracking on minimum wage, while at the same time spending the bailout money for the upper elite. There's a clear shift of money still going on here, and that means a shift of power that continues to go on. In the guise of this defending the middle class, which is not being done, we're seeing a shift of economic and political power even more draconian than we saw under Bush.
Bob, it is absolutely true, and I've written my share about it, including in my Wall Street book and Banker Occupation book, but I write articles occasionally. I have an article I'll put out tomorrow. I call it Economic Straight Talk. The economy is absolutely in the tank for the great majority of people. There is a protracted Main Street depression going on. Good jobs have been offshored for years. Incomes for most people, the great majority of people in the country, they began stagnating in the mid-1970s or so, and they've been either stagnating or going downhill. And the real economic numbers, based on the model that was used back in the 1980s, that has been absolutely corrupted several times, especially, I think, beginning in the Clinton administration and then continued under Bush and under Obama. But real unemployment isn't 7, 9, or 8, or whatever percent they officially quote. Real unemployment is 23% if it was calculated the way it was 30 years ago. Real inflation, based on the 1980s model, it's not 3%, it's 9%. 9%. And I like to put it this way, if I could remember my words. Anybody who eats, drives a car, heats a home, air conditions it, pays transportation bills, pays college tuitions, has medical expenses, they understand inflation better than the talking head economists that show up on TV or are quoted in the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or whatever. They understand inflation very, very well. They're getting hammered. Anybody on Social Security understands it. They get a 3% hike and their expenses go up another 6%. And elderly people, I guess I can put myself in that category. I'm on Social Security and Medicare. There's no question. I mean, elderly people are ones who have much higher medical expenses. A lot of things happen in senior years that aren't as frequent or sometimes don't happen at all when you're much younger and you feel indestructible. And these are people getting grossly harmed because this is the way the system has been structured. Obama is a liar, Bob. He's a serial liar. And I've said this too, and I've said that he literally has broken every single major promise he made. I can't think of a single one that he honored, and he won't honor it. I wrote twice about his State of the Union address before he made it and after he made it, and I made comments like his peace plan is permanent war. His Afghanistan plan is permanent occupation. His energy plan is drill, drill, drill. His labor program is destroying the ability of organized labor to bargain collectively. His education program is turning it into another business profit center, and on and on and on. And I've addressed all of these issues individually, and these are the plans that Obama fosters and supports. He wants to destroy Medicare. He wants to destroy Social Security. He wants to privatize them on the way to destroying them. He wants to erode Medicaid. He wants to screw ordinary people and hand the nation's wealth to America's elite, who already have too much, and to bankers and to other corporate favorites, and that's the Obama plan.
I would second that by saying that, in my mind, and I think you may have made reference to this in one of your articles, three things for people who doubt what you're saying. Simpson-Bowles National Commission on Fiscal Responsibility and Reform,
yes.
That would be one.
Yes.
American Jobs Act, that's number two, from 2011,
yep.
Right? And then a third one is the Trans-Pacific Partnership. Now, you just take those three. Those are three things that Obama pushed real hard for, got them. He's working those right now. And all they do is shift, again, it's what I was mentioning a moment ago, it's a shift of money, a shift of economy to the very top. And particularly the American Jobs Act of 2011, there's nothing in there about creating jobs that I could read. All I could read was the corporations benefiting this way, which, as said, will create jobs if we do this. That's a line that tired when Ronald Reagan was president. But yet that's the underpinning to the American Jobs Act. So I think you're right about all that. And then when he takes the podium at the State of the Union, his attacks on Republicans, if you call it that, is simply that they want larger austerity measures than I do. So we've got two parties that are have both shown themselves to be hostile to the people that they're supposedly governing. And the only thing that Obama can say when he's being candid, like in very little glimpses during the State of the Union address, is they want more austerity than I do, so my plan is best. That's the best he can do.
Well, that's the best he can do. I wrote about the Jobs Act a couple of times. His idea of a job creation program is tax cuts for corporations. Tax cuts for corporations and continuing the Bush tax cuts for rich people. I swear to God, that's the essence of his plan. I think it was about 80% of it, and there were crumbs thrown at ordinary people, and he calls that job creation. Well, Obama isn't a job creator. I think I said this in my article. His idea of a jobs program is destroying them, because that's what he's done. The good jobs are disappearing. Anybody who's lucky to have a job, they probably need three of them. They're low pay or temp jobs. They have few or no benefits. Nothing is being done to help them. None of this is being addressed. And his overall prescription, when people are in dire condition and need help, is slam them on the back of the head with austerity and make it tight, make it mean and nasty, and hit them again. You know the old football line, hit them again harder. Well, that's Obama's line. Hit them again harder. Hit them again when they're down. I mean, kick them in the butt and kick them again. And that's Obama's stimulus plan and job creation plan and helping ordinary people who are really suffering tremendously. He never says a word about growing poverty. They're really, it may be at record levels, certainly record homelessness and hunger levels and overall deprivation levels. I mean, it's shocking what's going on. He says nothing about this, and he claims that things are getting better. Things are getting worse. They're getting much worse. And at the end of the year, I absolutely predict, I wish I could put money on it, that things will be a lot worse than they are now. It may be okay for the Wall Street boys, for the corporate boys, but for ordinary people, it's going to be hard times getting harder.
I thought of two things as you were just finishing with your last couple of lines there. Number one, these kind of mirror each other. Number one, there was a program that I just saw not long ago called Overdosed, and they kind of make reference to what you were saying in this regard, that because the Fed has purchased something like $2 trillion worth of assets since 2008, they keep pumping money into the corporate system, calling it bailouts and those type of things, and basically just printing money and throwing it into the system for those people. Now, that's where that asset bubble gets inflated. I can't see how any economy can survive that. I don't know how and when it's going to pop, But when that bubble pops, it's going to be a serious pop, and everybody's going to feel it all the way down to the marrow of their bones when that happens. And that kind of scares me when I see that, if they're right. Because while you said Obama's been attacking the living standards of the majority, and I think that's clearly true, but at the same time talking out of the other side of his mouth, saying, well, we're creating jobs and all that, which is not true. I mean, it's just a little tiny fraction of things. He turns around and he appoints Jacob Lew Treasury Secretary, the ex-Citigroup executive, who got $1 million bonus right after the bank got bailed out, and the Senate fawned over him, if you watched his confirmation hearing.
I didn't watch, but I can imagine.
And he was unapologetic about making cuts, flaunting his credentials under the Clinton administration and what they did. He said directly in his hearings, we eliminated and cut social programs, and he said it proudly, and he's right. When he served as Clinton's budget director in the Office of Management and Budget, the Balanced Budget Act of 1997 was Lew's creation, which included $112 billion in Medicare cuts, and he's proud of it.
He's a
got a $940,000 bonus right after he bailed out.
He's a phony. I wrote about him. I wrote about the new Interior Secretary, Sally. Good Lord, I forget her last name. I'll check it during the break.
Oh, I know. Oh, yeah. I got to think of her name. Yeah, I know who you're talking about.
I never heard of her before. I looked her up. We got to take a break. We'll come back and pick this up right after the break, Bob. With Bob Emily, talking about a lot of big issues, Bob. We're really covering a lot of ground. Sally Jewell is the new Interior Secretary. The title of my article was Big Oil's in Good Hands with Sally Jewell. I wrote two articles on John Kerry. One of them, what was my title? One of them was Israel's Man at State. And the other one was Imperial Warrior Kerry at State. I wrote about Hillary Clinton leaving the office, Kerry not missing a beat, taking over. Clinton, arguably, if not the worst, certainly one of the worst secretaries of state America ever had. I quoted somebody once calling her a war goddess. She never saw a war. She didn't love and crave and want more of them. She craves killing and destruction. She did all kinds of despicable things. Jack Lew, I think my title for him was Wall Street's in Good Hands with Jack Lew, and there may be somebody else I wrote about. I forget. I want to cover the big one. Treasury is big. State is big. Oh, I wrote about Hegel and Brennan for sure. I wrote about both of them. If anybody thinks Hegel is a saint, the last thing Hegel is a candidate for is statehood. I don't know what he said. I do know what he said or didn't say in the past. I quoted things he said about Israel and Iran, that a war wasn't his first option on Iran, something to that effect. And he said, on Israel, he said a lot of things. One of them was, he said, I'm an American senator. I'm not a senator from Israel. Well, damn right he was an American senator. He was also a corporate crook. He left that out. He rigged his election. Oh, in the 1990s, I don't have the date in front of me, but he was in a very close race for the Nebraska senatorial race, and he won by a fairly good margin. He won because he was the CEO or one of the principals of an electronic voting machine company that just happened to tally the votes in Nebraska, and they rigged the election so John Hegel would be a U.S. senator. I do not support John Hegel. The only problem, Bob, is whether it's Hegel or Bagel or anybody else, you're not going to get anybody who's going to do the right thing in that job or in any other job in high places. They'll support the imperial agenda. They'll support neoliberal harshness. They'll do everything the rich wants and the corporate people want, and they'll absolutely screw ordinary people. And it doesn't matter whether it's Hegel or whether it's Kerry, Hillary Clinton, Jack Lew, they all come from the same cut of cloth. They're all, call them what you want, they're certainly not people's candidates, people's representatives. They're anything but that.
There's another name you need to toss in there, and that's Penny Pritzker. I first came across her name during the Bush years, and she was part of the planners of the Bush administration's economic policies. And now Obama, according to rumors, is going to name her the next Secretary of Commerce. And she's got a real dark closet that needs to be opened up as well, but it won't be.
She comes from the Hyatt family.
Right, she's from the Hyatt. Yep, she's from the Hyatt family.
Well, I didn't forget about her during the 2008 campaign. She was either Obama's main fundraiser or one of his main fundraisers, and she did it with, you know, precious stolen money, the usual kind of stuff. And I wrote a great deal about Penny Pritzker back then, but I haven't mentioned her since. Yeah, she's an important figure. She's a Chicagoan.
Oh, she is. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
There you go. One Chicago into another there, but she's going to be in the cabinet now as Commerce Secretary, so it might be something that people want to look at with her, because she has a pretty dark background in terms for us. I mean, those that come from a viewpoint of trying to keep things on the up and up for the people.
Oh, if she's appointed, and I'll bet you you're right, Bob, I bet she is appointed, I absolutely will write something again about Penny Pritzker. There are a lot of skeletons in her closet, and I'm going to haul out the ones I know and look for any new ones.
You had mentioned John Brennan, too. I have to mention this because I found this to be, actually, I had to laugh because it's incredible nature of what he said was so, such a bald-faced lie. I can't believe nobody called him on it, but nobody did call him on it. When during his confirmation hearings, nobody really asked him any challenging questions. They all just kind of, again, they stumbled over each other to fawn on him. But I remember when...
Oh, dear, I think we got cut off. Well, let me pick it up, and we'll get Bob back on the line. They absolutely didn't lay a glove on John Brennan, and his comments were completely outrageous, completely outrageous. He said things like, justify, ask questions like, how do you go about killing somebody? Well, I don't remember the wording of the question, but he justified killing people on the basis of wanting to save future lives. And on another program, I discussed Brennan, and I said something to the effect that if I was on that Senate committee, I would ask him, how did he acquire his amazing clairvoyance skills? How did he happen to find? How does he happen to determine that somebody plans to kill someone with no evidence whatsoever, with no intention that anybody is aware of? There's certainly nothing publicly known. How does he know this to be able to pick out targets and kill them and be able to save lives? Well, of course, the answer is simple. He has no idea what's going on. They pick and choose. They kill who they want. They can be U.S. citizens. They can be anybody. Bobby, you back on? We'll get back on again. They'll kill who they want to kill. They'll give any reason as a pretext. Again, they're all lies. They do what they want to do. How many more people will die? How many more innocent people will die? Well, this is the U.S. agenda, and Brennan will be the one that will be, I call him in an article, the maestro of murder. Well, that's exactly what he is, and he's Obama's man, and Obama is another maestro of murder. Bob, I know you're back on again. Let me let you make your comment about Brennan.
When did you lose me?
I heard a click.
Yeah, I heard a click, too, and I wasn't sure how far I had gotten in. I think I was saying that nobody had challenged Brennan at all during his confirmation hearings. But when I heard Senator Susan Collins, who I think is a Republican from Maine, ask a question about drone use in Pakistan and Afghanistan and the what Stanley McChrystal had said, that the people there consider it to be a sign of American arrogance, and that I remember his line that they're hated on a visceral level by the people of Pakistan and Afghanistan. Well, she asked Brennan that, and Brennan said that it's important that we remember that people in these targeted areas welcome the work that the U.S. has done with their drones. In other words, his perception is the people there are saying, kill us, we're fine with that. So this is the kind of person that you have going up before the Senate and them sleeping through the confirmation, and Obama knowing exactly full well that Brennan was one of the supporters of the extraordinary rendition under Bush and torture under Bush and secretive state killing under Bush, and that Jacob Lew is doing what we were talking about. They know full well They're not talking about it, and nobody is shaking a fist or even saying anything in the mainstream media when Brennan makes such outrageous comments as the population of Pakistan and Afghanistan really love when we drop bombs on them. I mean, this has gotten to the point that it's almost dark comedy.
Yeah, it really is, Bob. I mean, it's shocking to make a statement that somebody would say, you killed my wife and children, and you injured my mother and father, and you killed my brother and sister, and I want to thank you for getting rid of these terrorists in my country.
Yeah.
Does anybody believe crap like that?
But why is nobody saying anything about this? This is the thing that you had mentioned this earlier, and I keep going back to this myself. Why is it that nobody can get up the courage to even comment negatively about that and say, look what this guy is saying, he's a liar. And they're all liars, like you're saying, and yet here we are, and you and I have to talk about this, and your audience, no doubt, is well aware of all of this, but most people on Main Street aren't, because they're not told. If that gets cut out of the media coverage, along with all these other things that we've been talking about, along with, if I can bring this up, I don't know if this shifts it in a different direction, but Obama has also claimed, this came out about 2 weeks ago or so, not even 2 weeks ago, I don't think, Obama has claimed preemptive power to order a cyberware attack on any country that they believe is, again, here we go, an imminent threat. If they see that a country has the ability to do something in terms of cyber technology that they don't, Obama has claimed to have the green light to go ahead and attack that computer system of that nation, so it could take down, you know, power plants, hospitals, and transportation systems, and things of that nature. And Obama said, I, as the president, am the only one that's allowed to do that. Of course, who he's got an eye on? China and Iran, of course. We've already done it with the Stuxnet virus, but now he's claiming that he's the only one that is allowed to do that. Even though we're the only nation that has ever done that, if he determines another country is cyber imminent as a threat, here we go. I can go ahead and attack them by computer as well.
Well, that's exactly right. That was another topic I wrote about. I called my article, Obama Declares Global Cyber War. You know, there are no threats out there, Bob. So America invents threats, and you can act against them in different ways. You can wage hot wars. You can wage cyber wars. You can wage political wars with sanctions and those kind of things. You can wage financial wars, you know, economic sanctions that really put the screws on ordinary people. And that's the reason economic sanctions are imposed. I've written so much about Iranian sanctions, and they're blatantly lawless. If you look at international law, there is no justification in the world about targeting a non-belligerent country and imposing extreme hardships that cause great pain and suffering on ordinary people. Some of them, maybe they can't get the vitally needed drugs. I think the Iranian sanctions say something to the effect, either say something to the effect or don't specifically ban medications. But drug companies are afraid that maybe there's something they have that America could conceivably call dual use. I don't know how you call a drug you take for a disease dual use, but, well, that's what they say. Whether they mean it or not, I don't know. So they won't ship vital medications, and it causes hardships in Iran and other things that are banned, and they don't let them in. But overall, the sanctions cause ordinary people great harm. The people who are well off or the people who run the country, they're just fine. They don't have any problem at all. And the notion is to inflict public pain to get the ordinary people to blame their government for the duress that they're going through. They tried this with the Iraqi sanctions in the 1990s that killed at least 1.5 million people and got Dennis Halliday, one of the oil for food humanitarian coordinators, to resign his post, and he said he did it because he didn't want to be complicit in genocide, and he defined what he meant. He said it's killing 5,000 Iraqi children every single month. That's what the sanctions did. They're not as bad on Iran, but they can be pretty bad. And again, sick people can't get the drugs they need. There are other things they can't get that they need. But in Iraq, as much as the people may have despised Saddam, they turned to him for support because who else else do they have? So whether they love their government or they hate their government or they have mixed feelings, there's nobody else they can rely on but their government. So instead of turning the people against the government, they bring them much closer to the government for any help they can get, because anything is better than nothing. And America knows that, and they still impose these draconian sanctions and do all of these other things. I call these crimes against humanity. I don't know what else to call them, Bob.
Well, it's a crime of aggression, according to international law. It's just not done with a bomb. It's done with a targeted economic strike. So, I mean, I can tag on to that, that, as you know, the thing was just a week ago that Obama announced that the P5 plus one group has decided, of course this is taking a dictate from Obama, that they're going to slap more sanctions on Iran. And this time they're not just targeting the drugs and the oil, which they already have targeted, as you made reference to, but they're targeting the Iran Broadcasting Company and Iran electronics industries, none of which have anything to do with the country's nuclear program. It's clearly aimed at destabilizing and attempting to put the regime in a noose. But you're right. What's happened is, I mean, it has had an impact. The oil exports, for example, are down about 50% of what they usually are, and the currency in Iran has really suffered as a consequence, and inflation skyrocketing. And now we've got all these problems going on where the people are coming closer to their government as a result. What are you going to do with that? The sanctions are doing exactly the opposite of what they're supposed to do. But Obama calls them human rights.
Some human rights. Well, you can see the way Iranians feel about their government. When something important happens, when their leaders speak, big crowds assemble to hear them. On the 10th of February was the 34th anniversary of the Iranian Revolution. I wrote a long article about the 33rd one a year ago, and I included the 34th in another article about Iran. Just around the 10th, I put that out. I either got it out the 9th or the 10th, just around that date. There were massive crowds, millions of people assembled around the country in Tehran and in other cities, and they did it supportively of their revolution. There have never been crowds in America coming out to support their government that way. You get big crowds coming out when people like Martin Luther King were around. They came out for him. They didn't come out. They came out for him and against the government back in the Vietnam days. But the people came out supportively. Whatever it is about their government they would like better than it is, they certainly show support for it. And it was very, very evident on February 10th, their anniversary date, and that says a lot. You can see it in the way they act. That explains the way they feel, and they deplore America. They know what America is doing to them. They know the problems they have lie right at America's doors, and if there is any enemy of Iran, well, there are two enemies, because Israel does the same thing. It's America and it's Israel, and they can point fingers at the complicit European governments that go along, and some of the ones in the region, like the Gulf states, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Bahrain, a few others that go along with these horrendous policies. But they know who their allies are, and they know who their enemies are. They certainly understand it a lot better than America knows what the heck is going on. Bob, are you there?
Yeah, right. You lost me, Steve, and then he just called back, and we just got back on, so
okay.
I just caught the
last
you were saying. I don't know what happened. I switched phones just in case it was my phone, but I've been using the same phone for years here. Hopefully this will work.
Well, hopefully it will. It happens every now and then, not too often. Could be just a slip someplace or other. I was just saying that the Iranians are supporting their government because who else do they have? And it showed up on their anniversary date, the revolution date, when millions came out supporting them of their government. This never happens in America.
Oh, right. Yeah, it doesn't happen in America, but it better start happening in America. I mean, maybe if we get back over to let Americans know how much Obama's spying on them, maybe that will help. I mean, on Monday of last week, Google released a report saying that Obama administration requests for Internet information from users increased 85% over less than a two-year period. So that the Obama administration government has asked for like 16,000, well over 16,000 information on well over 16,000 citizens on what they're doing and what they're using the internet for, and that's expanded worldwide to like 50,000 requests for the U.S. government, and Google and Skype and the others are all just going right in line saying, okay, here you go. So the Obama administration, again, makes the claims that it does not have to follow things like the Electronic Communications Privacy Act of 1986 because they're exempted because they're looking at information that's 180 days old. None of that stuff matters because now it's email and now it's internet stuff. So maybe that angle will help people. If they can't get into the Iran thing, or they can't get into the fact that Israel bombed Syria a couple of weeks ago, so that they're now actually escalating the violence to an international level, again, the war crime of aggression we were talking about, well, let's come back home again. Do you know the Obama administration is taking your information on your emails and your internet use and finding out where you're going and what you're doing with that? And it's subject to absolutely no oversight, and the corporations, all of them, Facebook, Twitter, Skype, BlackBerry, they're all just handing over what we're doing on the internet to the Obama administration. So this is all, I mean, everything we've talked about from beginning to end, Stephen, has been dictatorial power that we're seeing being summoned up here in everything that we have talked about. We've got to start making some type of concerted response to that, or it's going to be too late. Friendly fascism, as the book says, is here.
Friendly fascism is here, and it's a book that I've talked about in articles in the past. Bertram Gross wrote it in the 1980s. Saying things like, when fascism comes to America, it'll be wrapped in the American flag. You know, smiling president, smiling Obama, smiling Bush, smiling Clinton. They're all masks. Strip off the mask and you see the devil behind them. The real face of America. Yeah, I mean, we're a hair's breadth from full-blown tyranny, Bob. It literally is that way. And, I mean, the laws, at the end of 2007, it was 2007, just before the presidential year, 2008, I wrote an article called Police State America. I simply reviewed all the police state laws that passed under George Bush, not just the laws like the Patriot Act and Homeland Security Act, but presidential executive orders and memos and memoranda and things like that. And you go through that stuff. It's all in the public record. It's all there. I mean, this is police state stuff. There's nothing else you can call it. And Obama piled on more of his own. Early in his administration, either first year or second year, he declared the right to detain anybody indefinitely on his say. No trial, no charges, throw him in prison, keep him there on the allegation this person may be a threat. And then National Security Authorization Act last year, repeated again this year. Any American citizen can be arrested by the U.S. military, thrown in a military dungeon, same thing, held there, put on trial in a military tribunal. Don't try them at all. Don't charge them. Leave them there. Leave them there for life. This is the law of the land. This is what Obama insisted on. This is legislating tyranny. I mean, we may be a hair's breadth away, Bob. You and I can be on this program, and we don't get shut down, and the FBI doesn't barge in and arrest us. But who knows? Will we be able to do it a month from now, a year from now, by the end of Obama's term? I'm not so sure we will be.
Yeah, I actually think it's an open question, and you had mentioned at the top of the hour that I might have another manuscript or two finished, and you're right. I've got one finished now that I've got to put the finishing touches on that I'm temporarily entitling We Hold These Truths, an updated manifesto for the tired, the poor, and the huddled masses yearning to breathe free. And it covers all this ground that we're talking about now and saying that I use the term fascism very advisedly and in a traditional sense, that when you have a small group of wealthy people who run businesses and run government together, that's what you have as fascism, and they actually have all of the power. That's what I mean by fascism, and that's what I mean when I say fascism is here. And when it takes the next step, it becomes totalitarianism, and unless the huddled masses yearning to breathe free start looking at this step-by-step process and start backpedaling or forcing our government to backpedal, we may not be able to do it once we realize that it's here.
Once it's here, it may be too late, Bob. That's exactly
true.
That's
what I'm saying, yeah.
We better do something. It's not the America I grew up in, which certainly was never beautiful, but things are so infinitely worse now. I never thought or worried about these things. It seemed like we were moving in the right direction when I was growing up. New Deal, Fair Deal under Harry Truman, Great Society under Lyndon Johnson. So we still had the Korean War and the Vietnam War and all the rest of the horrors going on, but there were some good things going on, too. Now everything has been turned to manure. Can I give you a fast bulletin before we sign off? Here's a brief, can't call it an article. It's a short three-paragraph statement on global research today, and it's titled, Russian Duma Vice Speaker, the meteorite was a U.S. weapon, the meteorite that exploded over Russia and injured about 1,200 people. He says it was a U.S. weapon, and John Kerry supposedly tried to contact the Russian foreign minister. Well, he knew he couldn't get him because he was either en route or he was visiting Africa, and he was unable to answer his cell phone or something like that.
He was at one of the seven houses that don't have a phone.
I honestly don't know. Bob, we're out of time. I thought I would tuck that in before the end of the program. I very much look forward to your new book. By the way, when it comes out, we're absolutely going to talk about it on this program, and I very, very much look forward to getting you back on very soon. I'll send you an email when we get off air.
Okay, thanks, Steve. Good to talk to you again.
Thank you, Bob. Join us again tomorrow, 1 p.m. Eastern Time, like Saturdays, and we're on Fridays at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. Make it a regular habit.